Welcome to the Plant Grow REIT podcast.
Welcome back to Plant Grow REIT podcast. I'm Jasmine, the PNC advisor for Aintree Group, and today I am joined by a very special guest, Dr. Natalie Flatt. Natalie is the co-founder and director of Connect Psych Services, an EAP service dedicated to improving employee well-being both within and beyond the workspace. She is a psychologist with a passion for early intervention in mental health and researching the efficacy or health technology. Of health technology. I wear glasses, but often, you know, I look at things and I have to double check. I'm like, oh, off. So welcome, Natalie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Jasmine. That's so nice to be here.
We're very lucky to have you on the podcast. So let's just start by asking a very good question. What are some of the common misconceptions you see when it comes to EAP services? So the information being private and confidential. I know that's something that some people might be like, is it really? Or, you know, that sort of side of stuff.
100%, Jasmine. Now, what the word EAP? It's been a little bit knocked around, I think, over many, many years. And look, it's you know, from a positive perspective, what we're seeing, it's going through a bit more of a transition into looking at, you know, how we can then provide that human-centric or employee-centric support. And this is what we really strive at Connect Psych Services, is that, you know, that we had to take, you know, all those common misconceptions and make sure that they were addressed. And one thing, exactly what you said, it's around the confidentiality. There has been an inherent amount of or lack of trust, you know, from especially when employees believe that the EAP, the way it's positioned to be more organizationally led or HR led, that they believe that the, you know, the discussions that they have are not confidential, and that data and those conversations will get back to that workforce, and then what that might mean to their jobs. So that is that's a real concern still, you know, for employees. But there's also, it's just even the way that I think EAP is really even positioned within the workforce, is that, or the workplace, that it still has to be a work-related issue. So we hear a lot of that, that, you know, what I'm going through is not a work-related issue. And, you know, I think that, you know, within the boundaries between personal and professional life, they're very blurred, aren't they? It's not as if we can just walk through a door, our workplace door, and leave everything that might be going on within our life behind us. We are not robotic like that. So those stress challenges,
no,
what we're talking about,
certainly aren't.
The health challenges, you know, financial concerns, they're going to affect a person's well-being, and that is going to affect performance and productivity. And you know, the EAPs, they do recognise this, and it's just the way we position that in the workplace. You know, some people also believe that EAP should only be used as that reactive approach, and for crises or emergencies. So, you know, those real contemporary EAPs are again trying to buck this narrative, you know, that we can provide a wide range of proactive preventative services that really help the employees thrive rather than just surviving or using it as that reactive approach. So early intervention, as you know, really is the key. So that's something that, you know, I think Connect Psych, we really try and hone down in on. But even, you know, from a Band-Aid perspective, a lot of workplaces or employees believe, oh, it's just three sessions. That's not going to actually cover any of my needs. So why do I bother? That could be true. Okay, I'm not suggesting that it's not, but it's a great start. And, you know, at Connect Psych, we offer a continued care model. So, you know, if you do start and you do open up and you do find this is a great avenue to be able to discuss, and workplaces will only give you a number of sessions, we can actually provide that continued care in another channel of Connect Psych Services. So that's something else that I feel that is a little bit of a misconception there. It's not a Band-Aid approach to all EAPs.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because, as you said, it three sessions, I mean, it can just sort of scratch the surface and it can just help to start the conversation. And so I think it is really important to, if you have access to something like an EAP, to use it, because it may not be now, but maybe in a few months' time, you might go, oh, that was actually really helpful. Because sometimes in the moment, we often don't realize that what we're hearing is what we need to hear. And it might take a little bit to settle in. And then it's like, oh, that was actually useful. Maybe I will go back. So I think that's really helpful. And in terms of the misconceptions, do you find that it's a generational thing? Like, do you find that a lot of the younger generation are more like, yes, I'm going to use this service that's being offered to me? Do you find that the resistance maybe comes from older generations that have sort of not necessarily had access to this a lot throughout their employment?
Oh, absolutely, Jasmine. We do definitely see through our, we've just released our 5-year trends analysis report. I can send that through to you after our podcast for anyone's interested. But we are seeing that the increased use of the Generation Y and the Generation Z high users over the Gen X and the baby boomers. So the more that they are utilising the services, because we believe is around the better mental health literacy, because that they really do want to enhance their learning and also their development, not only in professional but then also personal lives, and they also like to take action. They have all, you know, been brought up in a, I suppose, more so an environment where it's okay to not be okay. And, yeah, you know, I suppose that when you look at the Gen Xers and even the baby boomers, the narrative was very different. It was a, you know, a little bit more of a, you know, just get up, get back on the horse. You'll be okay. Yeah. She'll be right. I'm fine. So we see that is the usage is a little bit different, but also the reaction to the usage is a little bit different. Whereas, you know, some the older generation believes that they're more resilient than the younger generation. That's not necessarily the case. It's all around how comfortable you actually feel. But with, as I said before, is that it's also the evolution of the EAPs and how they've been, you know, set up. They're very different than what they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago. COVID was certainly a massive help there. But, you know, especially with what we do as well is that online support. So what we have is that disinhibition effect occurring, where you've got a distance between yourself and the practitioner has actually allows you to be a lot more honest, a lot more open. So just the service delivery has also changed. So you've got to take, it's a couple of variables that are at play in there as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, COVID changed a lot of things and a lot more things became online. And so whilst that made things more accessible, I know that there's still some people, and I don't know if you find this, that would much rather just have a conversation with someone face-to-face than online, because it's like, oh, it's, you know, all that sort of stuff. Do you find that that happens a lot?
It's an interesting assumption. I think it comes down to, you know, we live in such a fast-paced world, and obviously technology has really, you know, created, I suppose, that frenetic feeling within us and continually sitting a little bit more so in that fight or flight response. And for those that I agree that could prefer the face-to-face, it actually comes down sometimes to convenience. And it is, so even if it's convenient to be able to talk to someone that's online, we are finding that people would choose that. And so that's a really interesting concept. So we still believe that 90% of the individuals that we talk to would still actually prefer the online. Also, just around the face-to-face, sometimes this is where it takes a little bit of time to actually find the right person and the right fit. So you can spend a lot of time going out and booking that session. More often than not, a face-to-face session will take a lot longer to wait for. And then when you reach that session, you've taken maybe even the day off work and you go to speak to that practitioner, you realise that they're not the best fit. And this is something that we're really careful and cognizant of at Connect Psych. So we actually created a narrow AI approach of best fit practitioner to be able to minimize that for the employee and the experience. And so especially, you know, when we have practitioners that are scattered all around Australia and New Zealand, that it doesn't matter what location you actually live in, you can actually be able to connect in with the practitioner that's going to be best suited to what you're going through. And so that's very important. And it also then allows for an extension of time. So our practitioners, they work from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. 7 days a week, especially for those workplaces where work design is more rigid, like even healthcare and transport and education, that they're able to have those out-of-hours sessions. And so we see that around 25% of the workforce that we support is still as having those out-of-hours, workplace hours sessions there. So that's I hope I've answered that question, but I feel that even though the preference may be there, it could just come down to convenience now.
Yeah. No, and I think so much of our world is online, and I know there's still some people, and albeit it's probably from an older generation, it's like, oh, it's online, and, you know, they would definitely prefer face-to-face. But I think you're exactly right. By the time you get into a face-to-face appointment, it's so far down the track. And then if you're, you know, it can feel sort of weirder and it's like, oh, maybe this isn't the right fit. Whereas online, it's flexible in terms of timing. But then also, if it doesn't work, you're not waiting sort of a really long time to maybe find somebody else, which I think is really important as well.
Absolutely. It's a, you know, with even, I mean, depending upon, you know, why the reason is that you've actually gone to book a session, more often than not, you're ready, you've contemplated it. And, you know, from that trans-theoretical model of change, that you are ready and you want to be able to be seen straight away. And we do. We live in that instant world. We live with the instant gratification. We can, you know, buy something off Amazon and it comes tomorrow. And so we're wanting things for a quicker and quicker. But when it comes to mental health and mental challenges or life events, we want them addressed sooner rather than later, because sometimes if we are waiting long enough, that actually might have actually simmered into something worse. Or it may have gone, you know what, I'm okay now. It's okay. And so we can deflect it and we can maybe cancel those sessions. And that's where either I call it the pebble in the shoe, is that we can have a couple of that pebble in the shoe may still be there, but no, it's okay. And this is what then ends up building up, because we'll then create that level of, dysfunctional behaviour over time if we are not being able to have that addressed when we're ready to have it addressed. And that's something else we take in consideration at Connect, is that none of our clients or our employees wait any longer than 48 hours for a session. So we're still capturing them in that contemplative and that, you know, action-based change mindset there. So we get a lot of success out of our sessions because of that.
Yeah, and especially when you said that a lot of the people, by the time they come to you, they're at their, it's the issue's in full effect, and it's not because it's a reactive measure as opposed to a proactive measure. So I think that is incredibly important. So the model at Connect Psych Services is all about humanizing digital health. As artificial intelligence becomes more integrated into our daily lives, what role do you see AI playing in the mental health services? Have you observed an increase in people turning to AI like ChatGPT rather than being like, oh, I'm going to book a session, I'm just going to ask ChatGPT, what does this mean? How should I be feeling? Is this an okay feeling? How have you sort of noticed that, and do you think AI gets a seat at the table?
Look, I'm with you, Jasmine, and we would be remiss to not be looking at that. We were really lucky that we utilized narrow AI in 2018 into our build. And then, you know, best fit practitioner matching and getting your choice and allowing the system to choose for you as the workflow goes down, it has actually been invaluable. And it's really been a huge benefit. And we've got the data behind us on how we utilize AI in the early days. Currently, we're utilizing AI, especially over our Rise platform. So our Rise platform is all of our employees have access to Rise, and it allows them to even ask our little chatbot, our Reva, on where we can actually find more information about a certain topic. And that just might be out of interest, out of support to help themselves or to support to help others. So we really focus on that outreach education as well to build up empathy and then, you know, for a positive consequence of psychological safety within teams when you get to know other people and what they might be going through there. So, you know, I think AI is going to still play a major role. Looking at that triage and that risk screening is really important. You know, we have a Kessler 10 that we utilize, which measures levels of distress. And when it reaches a certain number, our system will actually stop the workflow and then say, do you need to actually call Lifeline or 000? So our system is able to pick up on that. And that will then, you know, that will expand as AI, you know, moves from moves probably more so into that agentic AI and the sentiment analysis that's actually starting to be built in now into systems there. So a really important component of that regarding that risk screening. We're looking again, even in, you know, to that those predictive analyses, which is really important. It's that how can we get ahead of this curve? You know, we can AI is going to be able to detect patterns that might indicate worsening mental health, you know, languages, absenteeism. So a lot of organizations are starting to look at, you know, what EAP can provide by way of data, and this is something we're doing as well, and then workplace data insights, and then putting them together and seeing if there's any pattern here and what we can then do to intervene within a workplace. So really clever analytics there. With what you're saying with the ChatGPT, a very interesting point that we're looking at, levels of loneliness have gone through the roof. We all know that. Like, yeah, you know, that has been a huge one there. People are using even ChatGPT as a measure to mitigate loneliness. The problem with the likes of ChatGPT is that it's open AI, right? So from an ethical, an ethical issue here is that if there is a real mental health challenge, how does AI actually contribute to supporting them? Or is there a detriment? And then who's responsible for that? So that's something from an ethical perspective a lot of governments are actually really, really careful of right now. On a positive note, this is actually, as we know, that we can start to build in, everyone's building their own systems, and a lot of individuals are building their own systems. And this is a great way to really target those the missing middle, which Origin, you know, like to call here. And that missing middle is that I am starting to, you know, identify symptoms or some different trends that I might be going in and feeling that, you know, at certain times I'm feeling like this. Now, this is where an internal or a private system, like a coach, can really be able to be supportive to that individual and provide them those tips and strategies. But then also after a number of sessions that they might have, to say right now this is how far I can get. And, you know, a very clever AI is and connected to you know, person therapy is then able to move in to direct them into that person therapy. Even clever AI is that with the consent of that client to be able then to provide that script that they have been working with the client. So from a practitioner perspective, we're getting a great history intake and saving a lot of time and effort. So we're being able to then go and identify to the source. So it's not a replacement, I believe, but it can be a really good first step, and it's watch this space, it's coming.
Yeah, I completely agree. I went to an AI sort of webinar, not really a webinar, it was sort of like a seminar a few weeks ago, and we touched on it, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, we would be silly to think that people aren't using it, but it's then the ethical side comes into it. And it's really comforting to hear that your systems have that, like, oh no, maybe you should actually speak to someone now, or maybe you should call Lifeline, what's going on there. And I think that's really important to have, because it's not just a band-aid, and AI is always going to give you, more often than not, unless you ask for it, pretty positive feedback. And so, you know, it might be like, oh yeah, but you know, you go girl. And it's like, oh, but maybe that's not what they need in that moment. And it's sort of, maybe you need to actually have a conversation with someone and really kind of go through all of that. So, and also you touched on the fact that the information's then not shared unless it's with the consent. And I think that's also the other thing a lot of people don't realize with AI, like ChatGPT, all those conversations are being used for everyone. So anyone who sort of types in something with a similar issue, they might not necessarily be getting a response that they need. It's just based on what everybody else has sort of typed in. And so, yeah, it raises a really interesting, it's just an interesting thing to sort of be across and understand, because there's definitely big changes coming, I feel.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and a lot of considerations. So you're very right. It's not around algorithms. They're around needing to be on proper scripts written by clinical advisors.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So recently, being PNC, I have noticed that has been a deliberate focus on psychological safety in the workplace. What are your recommendations for organisations to tackle this, especially when it may be what I would consider a psychosocial hazard for someone like me is different for somebody in my team? So sort of making policies and procedures and things that we can do to benefit everybody as opposed to one person or individual.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to pick up on something here, Jasmine, because I think it's a really important distinction here. There's a difference between psychosocial safety and psychological safety. So let's just start with the psychosocial safety. So as you know, and you're very aware, and I think everyone in Australia is now aware, is that we're under different legislation to prevent psychological injury in the workplace. As it stands, this is costing four times the amount of money is going towards psychological injury claims compared to physical injury claims, and costing around Australia $39 billion a year. Each claim is approximately $55,000 a claim. So we're seeing a huge rise in these claims. So WorkSafe and ComCare have come together and created these psychosocial hazards. And there are now up to 17 psychosocial hazards. Now, this can be very overwhelming for many organisations, especially the P's and C's and the HRs, and you know, who is responsible for this? Is it HR? Is it the leaders? Is it teams? You know, look, at the end of the day, it's a shared responsibility. We all have a role to play in this, including the employees. So this is something that we should all know, not just the HRs and the leaders. We should all be aware of this and play a part to be able to reduce the risk of psychological injury within the workplace. On the other hand, the psychological safety is an opportunity for individuals to feel confident that they're able to speak up and on a number of issues and areas, which includes psychosocial risks, potential psychosocial risks, and know that there is going to be no reprimand for being able to speak up. Now, when we actually have a culture that feels confident to be able to speak up, and this can be an array of topics, and then know that opinion or that idea is then going to be taken seriously, and also maybe even workshopped in a couple of, you know, in a certain ways, then that's actually going to be able to enhance innovation and creativity. So we want to be working with both a psychosocial safety culture and then also a psychologically safety culture. So this is something that we just want to make sure that we can, you know, we can get it right, because they interact. You know, the psychosocial safety is about the preventing harm. Psychological safety is about more so promoting healthy practices and behaviours, but both are necessary. So, you know, without psychological safety, people might not be safe to speak up if something goes wrong. But a psychologically safe team, it can't thrive then in a toxic environment, you know, where job demands or exposure to harm are not properly managed. So you've got to just make sure that you're kind of addressing the two at the same time. So coming back to your question, just because I just wanted to make that.
No, that's okay. No, it is. As you said, they sort of go hand in hand, and it's a bit of a dance to sort of navigate, and it's, at times it can be such an individual thing, and that's what makes it really tricky, because as I said, what works for me may not necessarily work for others, and so trying to find that common ground without sort of creating more of a distance is really tricky. It is a very, you know, I'm not a dancer, but if I was, I would be pretty good by now, I reckon.
It is, absolutely, I could imagine. It's an added extra concern for a lot of P's and C's and HR here. But look, it's probably more about, you know, what are the hazards? So I would say that the common hazards here, we see a high work demands or job demands and high workload. So this is a big one here, and it's tackled across a lot of industries, especially again with the poor work design, so meaning or rigid work design, like educators, healthcare, transport, where they have to be on site for a certain time. But we're also then seeing that again in a lot of white collar, where around role clarity, you know, what is my job? What am I actually responsible for? And when I get told to do something, well, that's actually not within my description, and what's the parameters? And is there too many cooks in the kitchen? And so there's a lot of confusion about where do I stand within a workplace there? And that, I feel, has also been fed by poor change management. So we see a lot of restructuring happening. Okay, and when you actually are not having the appropriate communication, people are lost. People are going, okay, what do I do now? Where's my role? And so they can feel very disconnected and confused and anxious about, A, do I have a job? what's the security around my job, and what am I actually doing right now? So that's a big one there. But we also see the low support from peers and, you know, managers and supervisors, which can really then tie into also to the inadequate recognition and reward. You know, am I doing a good job? We all need to know if we're on the right track. And can I be praised? And how about even as a team, we've just gone on to this project, we've completed the project, and then all of a sudden my manager might be saying, right, next, rather than stopping, reflecting, feedback. It's a psychological safety piece. But also it's that, well, wait a sec. Oh, how despondent might I feel that was a really difficult project. We never got time to celebrate it, and we're already into the next one. And so that's actually a hazard. You know, the exposure to traumatic events, we can see that emotionally demanding workplace. We see it in healthcare, you know, disability services, even now the occupational workplace violence, aggression in education has really risen there. So that's just a kind of handful there out of the 17. But, you know, what do we want to do? How can we tackle this? You know, we at Connect Psych, we're really well versed in reducing psychosocial risk, and we work with a fabulous HR firm that's Global Citation Group that we work on the compliance and intervention piece there. And it's around, though, why workplaces can listen, observe, collect, and act. Now, if we can actually identify and then monitor where may be those psychosocial risk products, pockets, this is a great start. And I think that's where, you know, leaders can sit down and just to take that time to consider and listen, you know, like to their workers, you know, what stresses you out within your workload right now, or what's something that if you had a magic wand, you'd actually like to change. And so when you are gaining that collective understanding from the people within your your workplace or with even within your team, you're able then to start to establish, you know, where can we actually target, you know, and you know what, even where might be the low-hanging fruit, right? Recognition and reward. How easy is that even to put into that systems and going right after each project, we're going to be taking a morning off. We're going to be retroing it. We're going to be talking about feedback, what we could actually do better next time. But mainly, you know what, we're going to celebrate it. We achieved a milestone. You know, congratulations to everyone. What was everyone's strengths? What is everyone proud of? This will then enhance that motivation, but make people go, you know what, I've got a part in this workplace. So tiny things like that can really be able to enhance the workplace as a whole and reduce that area. You know, what's your supportive system actually look like? You know, do you actually have your workflow and your framework around how to report a hazard or how to be concerned about a hazard? So we know that SMEs, you know, they can range from 10 to 250 workplaces, and then the larger organizations can be dispersed everywhere. You can have rural, metro. Work out how are you actually going to be able to connect in what practices and systems are going to be able to integrate that in, so you can then highlight, you know, that piece there to identify that. So it's that clinical governance piece, and that HR strategy is really important there. You know, I think also just being able to, again, identify and measure in what's the lead. Like, so this is probably another piece there, is leadership training up to scratch? So how do leaders communicate? You know, we leaders are the cultural architects of a workplace. But a leader can then be placed in because of their skill set, not always because of their soft skills. So as we know, and I think as you know as well, after age 25, our lovely brains are completely formed. EQ is a lot harder to actually start to teach. So what can we then do to support the leaders that may not be as empathetic, and being able to build in that communication channel?
Yeah, I think that's a really big one. I'm very lucky because I grew up in a situation where I was sort of forced to be very emotionally intelligent, and I notice anything and everything down to body language and the tone in the way in which people speak and their patterns and everything like that. So I would consider myself to have a high EQ. But as you said, you know, by age 25, our brains are fully formed, and so EQ is harder to teach. How do you teach it for people that maybe didn't grow up in an environment where they necessarily needed to have a high EQ and sort of are now in leadership position? What are some tips that you have for organizations to be like, hey, this is a good place to just start?
Yeah. Look, it comes back firstly to self-awareness, doesn't it? So yeah, really,
oh yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
That's before you
it's
start
like
anywhere.
I'm so self-aware.
Yeah, it is. It comes to that self-awareness, and it is not, you know, what we try and say at Connect Psych, that this is not just one training program and thinking you can tick the box and hey, we've done a leadership training program. It actually takes a sustainable approach. When we're talking about leadership, our manager assist and support there, it's being able to have, you know, one-on-one support, group support, and then workshops around how to build emotionally intelligent teams. Now, what we come in, and especially with workplaces, we'll tailor this. So depending upon the industry, depending upon the generation, some people are going to say, hey, if we can actually crack this, you're actually going to get better performance and better KPIs. So they actually can focus on, we can focus on, this is actually going to help your performance. They're more likely to have that buy-in. So it's really building that empathy having that level of self-awareness there and opening up. Is it 100% always effective? Absolutely not. Nothing is always 100% effective. But what I always say is that if we can build in that practice, it actually gets easier. And this is, I feel, an imperative. It's imperative to businesses that we actually look at how emotionally intelligent is your leader, because we're now moving now again into the fifth generation of it workplace. So the Gen Alphas are coming in. So you can actually have workplaces that have got five generations. If you don't have a leader that is more sitting more so in the Gen X, more so in the Gen X, I'd say now, that is not emotionally intelligent, that actually can be a psychosocial hazard within itself.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right on the money there when it comes to self-awareness. I am very self-aware. I understand why I do what I do. And I think a really simple question to ask yourself is, why do I do what I do? Like, what is, where am I decision-making, where is it coming from? Because I make decisions based off things that happened when I was younger. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I can be very logical. And so if people, because sometimes it will happen being PNC, people will come up and they'll be quite upset. And so I'm very comfortable sitting in a room where people are visibly upset and, you know, being able to then cut through that. And I'm happy to sit there. And I always tell people, I think I find it such an honor to sit and have someone crying opposite with me, which sounds really odd, but it's, you feel safe and comfortable enough to come and just sit in my office. I have no expectation for you to tell me what's going on, but I will happily sit with you for as long as you need. And I think that can be really uncomfortable for people, but for some reason I can just switch off and it's just like, okay, I've just got to deal with what's in front of me. Someone's really upset. What does this person need? How can I help? How can I make it better? So yeah, I think being self-aware and sort of being able to take yourself out of difficult situations is really important when it comes to emotional intelligence, and being able to be reflective and go, okay, what's needed in this moment? Because it's not, oh, I've got to fix things. Sometimes it's just sitting in that discomfort and figuring out what that means for you and also that person. Because by doing that, sometimes you just need a few minutes some days, and it just makes everything else so much better. And then that little crack, I sort of feel, opens a pathway. And now people will come to me and tell me things, and I'm like, oh, okay, like I never told me that before, but that's good. It means that I've done something right along the way. And so it's always a really good thing. Because yeah, emotional intelligence is something that's very hard to teach and sort of explain to people.
But you're right. Like, you know, you can actually show that you care in different ways. And again, that's where we kind of come in and tailor it, because a post-it note that's written from the leader that might be a bit uncomfortable with emotions is just as impactful as what they can then say. So we never discredit that. We can even get, you know, the leaders to even start stand-ups, you know, at the start of the week, or staff meetings with, how's everyone feeling today? Use one adjective on how you are feeling. And then what that actually does is that it starts to show the body language and connect it to the emotion. So that everyone in the room is able to express how they feel, which can be a positive or negative. So it's great from an expansion of emotional vocab anyway, but it actually then allows everyone to go, oh, okay, you know, Jasmine today said she's actually feeling really frustrated. Well, actually, know it at home, you know, her kids might be really disruptive, or school holidays coming up, so I'm not going to load Jasmine up with a million and one things. So there can be different ways that you can actually be able to show some emotionally intelligent behaviors. And I always say to all the employees, especially if you've got the leader that may be fearful or maybe just that typical, you know, stoic, dare I say, individual there, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that is okay. Give them feedback. And if they did something that you feel as an employee might be out of their comfort zone, go and tell them that. Go and say, I really felt so appreciated when you did that. I know that might have felt uncomfortable to you or different for you, but just let you know I feel appreciated. So they, once they can get that 360, again, they can bank that and then they can try that again. So the emotional intelligence, as I said, it's got to be a sustainable practice, but you can get there.
Yeah, I really like that sort of with the stoic leader. It's like, yeah, I don't know about many people, but I know I've had some of those leaders in the past, and it's like, yeah, they've always appreciated when I've gone up to them and said, I actually appreciated that you did this. I know it wasn't easy. So, yeah it's really good to hear. How can leaders model healthy behaviors without overstepping or oversharing in a workplace? Because obviously it is, once again, that dance. It's how much do you give and how, you know, like, oh, where does the line sit depending on the situation?
You know, we want our leaders to lead by example. So we certainly want leaders to show a level of vulnerability. But I've also believed that that vulnerability is, you know, it's that action that we can then take after that to say, you know, these are the times that I'm feeling, you know, I'm feeling really stressed right now. This is, I've got this going on, and I've got a lot going on. You know, so today I'm going to leave an hour before, and this is what I'm going to go and do. I'm going to go and, you know, do some grounding, you know, go for a walk, get into the water, go, you know, go kick off my shoes to, you know, ground myself into the sand, or, you know, go and hang out with my kids, or go to the library, or do something that's an element of self-care. So when you can actually show that you can be vulnerable, but actually have an action attached to that, what you're showing your team is that it's okay to not feel okay, but I'm also not going to sit in, I'm going to acknowledge it, but I'm actually going to then go and do something about it. So you'll get a better flow in that way. And I think that creates a really action-based approach to well-being. Leaders also who we know have utilized the Connect Psych services, they feel, because they've actually had a go at it, they're more likely to go and say, you know what, like I've heard this from you, you know, a number of times, or I've, as you just said before, I've started to see the pattern or trend. Go and chat with Nat and Sash at Connect Psych. Like, go reach out to them. I never use the word EAP. We actually use our names. So we always go Nat and Sash at Connect Psych with all of our organizations, because we want to humanize it. Yeah. We just don't want to be that label. And so that's really helpful, because that's part of that acknowledging that they need to take a break, and that goes for leadership, and then also for for the employees. It's a funny one, because great leaders that can really lead by example, they also lead with curiosity. So being able to go, look, tell me a little bit about this. I'm not too sure about these Gen Zs. You know, hey, let's come and have a chat. Can we go for lunch? Teach me some lingo, or teach me. You know, just don't be open to curiosity, and say, you know, put your hand up going, I don't know, like, how would you like me to actually respond, or how would you like me to email, text, or call you? Like, you know, just being really more psychologically flexible and showing that to your workplace is that we can, there's so many methods to being able to get to the solution. Try not to stick to the method that you believe is right, because if leaders can actually show that I don't know all the answers, that's going to allow for that increase in psychological safety, and so that's that help seeking is really important to show, and again leading with that curiosity. So really easy tips. It doesn't have to be emotional. It can actually be, you know, really behavioural, that is going to help a leader lead better.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's also really funny, because the other week, where my office is, I've got quite a number of young people that sit out the front, and I said, you know, what? Teach me some of the language, and I can tell you, I absolutely used it out of context without realizing, and it was a bit of fun for the afternoon. But I definitely, there's some things that they were telling me, and I got said, it was a lot of fun, needless to say, sort of trying to understand that stuff, because sometimes you'll hear people say things and it's like, oh, I feel really out of touch, but really it's just such a different generation. And then when you find out what it means, it's like, oh, yeah, I would never have said that or whatever it may be. And so, yeah, and also when it comes down to the actions, you talk about grounding a lot. I'm very big on taking my shoes off, putting my feet in the grass. When it's not raining, there is a playground that's nearby that every now and then I'll just go sit on the swings and swing like I'm, you know, in primary school again, which is really nice. And it's just those small things on days where I'm really busy really help. And you're exactly right. Sometimes it doesn't have to be that emotional side. It's just, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to lead by example and show you that I'm maybe not okay in this moment, but I am. I'm doing something about it. I'm not just going to sit in it and accept that this is all it is. And it does. It shows a vulnerability that you're willing to do it. And people pick up on that, especially because we look up to our leaders. And so, exactly. Yeah.
And you don't know sometimes when you know, you've got a staff member that may be perceiving you as that leader in a certain light. I am chief mental health advisor at Superfriend in the city, and we have the most beautiful board. And I saw the chair of our board the other day, and I just, he's such a beautiful man, and he talked to me, you know, but, you know, my level of respect is so high. And then he's talking about how he, you know, had his 2-year-old little granddaughter the other day and had to go buy her an Elsa doll. And I'm like, oh, it just actually, it was just that different piece of glitter that I went, oh, now yeah. I'm respecting you more because you show me a little bit of human, you know, in that, you know, like it's, you showed me a lot of human, but it was just so sweet to see that reaction or the smile on his face. And it was it wasn't modeling any vulnerability. It was showing that I'm a human under whatever hat we wear, you know, that we want to be able to show that, take the hat off, and we're all pretty much the same.
Yeah. And I think that's something that we all forget, because it is. And I always say to our team members here, if it matters to you, then it matters. I don't have to know anything. And so if people come to me and say, hey, I want to give you this little bit of information today, that's where it's like, oh, okay, that's cool. Like, I didn't know that. I appreciate you telling me. Now I know a little bit more. And it does. It bridges that gap. And then it just allows people to feel more comfortable around you. And I think that's really important in a workplace to be able, and it comes back to that communication. If people feel like they can tell you stuff, those hazards reduce, and, you know, it becomes a really great working environment where the communication is open and nothing seems too great or nothing seems so out of touch that, oh, I couldn't ask for this. So I think that's really important as well.
Yeah. And I think as well is that once we find commonalities, you know, we're humans, we search for commonalities, and that actually enhances the connection. And again, what, you know, what data shows us is that when we can have a more connected workforce, that actually reduces the psychological distress within the workers. So they're actually reporting lower K10 scores. So it's a very important aspect. And to do that, we need that open communication, that little bit of vulnerability.
Yeah. And is there, sort of looking into the future with mental health and everything like that, what is your hope and what are you seeing for the future of mental health? So what are you hoping to see, and what is in the works at the moment?
Gosh, I think it's a really good question. I feel that there's a lot of models, and this is even coming from a government level as well, that are now starting to realise, that are now starting to move away from that reactive approach into that more proactive approach. So we're moving more into that enhancement, and this is fabulous. So let's see what we can actually do to identify symptoms before they turn into diagnoses. So this is so important for the economy of Australia, essentially. Like if you want to bring it down, like, you know, the impact of mental health on mental health challenges within the workplace, that will have a ripple effect out into the community. And we see this. We see this in services such as Lifeline and Beyond Blue, that the suicide rates and the cause of those for, you know, suicide, you know, to suicide support is actually on the increase. We see that psychological injury is on the increase. So what are we missing? So we need to stop and we need to review what we are not doing right. And what is not working. And it's, well-being is, especially in the workplaces, it's very bespoke. But it has to then be, you know, that's why we've taken the approach of, you know, if you've actually got a happy and healthy workforce, then you're going to then see their productivity and performance. So what can you then do to keep that, like to bring in to the mix of how a workplace should look by what your actually employees need and want, and it's going to actually work for them. So it probably just, again, comes back to that listening. But it's what we're now seeing is that we've got to then start to lead with a lot more proactivity. Technology is certainly going to play a part in this. But I also feel that there's a lot, and as you know, there's a lot of providers out there, you know, from an EAP perspective to training, you know, what is the impact of that? And let's get smart. And this is something else that we do with Connect Psych, is that we play in one swim lane. We do our one-on-one, you know, counselling services and manager support and training really well, okay? But we don't do nutrition. We don't do, you know, the HR kind of legality. We don't do the on-site physiotherapy. We don't do, you know, the mental health first aid and that's it. But we have amazing partners which we create a collab with, right? And so that is the joining forces to be able to create one cohesive model that's actually centralized. So that's something that Connect Psych are now working towards, is to build out, to expand our platform and to actually have those data points coming in from other providers. So a workplace is getting a really great snapshot on what good, strong well-being actually looks like. So we are moving into more of those corporate health models. And whether or not that is going to look like memberships or, you know, what are those kind of more so those perks, we'll realign them, we'll re-evolve them, but it's all going to come back to the data. What is the data saying to us? And that's what's going to dictate what is going to be best practice. That's where I think the future is going to lead: proactive, cohesive, centralized, data-led.
Yeah, I think it's definitely heading that way. And I mean, so many people, they want to go to one place and not, and then it's like, oh, I can centralize, I know where to go. And if you've also got that relationship with like Connect Psych Services and your team of psychologists, well, then they're obviously going to trust more what you recommend in, hey, this is a really good partner, go down this place, this path for nutrition, and you know, so on and so forth. So I think it's really good, and I agree. I think being proactive and just the data is going to help a lot in the future.
You know what it's like, Jasmine, don't you? That if you've got siloed data sets and you don't know how they're actually interacting, then how do you know it's impactful? So you know, we look at what we've done with e-health records and you know, being able to have that centralized piece of what you've been doing and what you're prescribed. It doesn't matter what doctor you might have gone to or physician, it's all kind of coming back into that. So that's really important to be able to understand the person, especially, you know, we're talking about the issues of over-prescription in that scenario. Yep. But it's also like workplaces are going to become tighter, like as in not like, you know, they're going to actually become more discerning around what they're paying for and seeing the impact of that on their workforce. And that's because of a time saving, again, cost saving, but also energy saving. So being able to have one system that then is going to be able to provide you all those data points. And I mean, my magic wand there would also then be able to integrate data points from your HR list. You know, what's your absenteeism like, your turnover rate like, your presenteeism like? So we can then able to get a really strong narrative on what you need as that workplace.
Yeah, I think that's so important, because we often, if you can figure out the patterns, you can understand how to fix them. And I'm such a big believer in that. So yes, you're always going to have busy periods throughout the year. So being an accounting firm, professional services firm, whether it's the legal team, we always know the billing at the end of the month is going to be a little bit more hectic than other times of the month. And obviously around tax lodgements and all of that sort of stuff, it's going to be busier. So really understanding how to support your team in those moments and the effect that that then has is really beneficial. And so, yeah, I think you're right in terms of how everything's interconnected will play a really big part. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Natalie. We really appreciate your time and your insights. And thank you to our listeners for joining in. Please subscribe whenever you get wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll chat again soon. Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So did I, Jasmine. Thanks so much for having me. Take care. Chat soon.